This is Bristol, and you are listening to a podcast from the Bristol Confringe reading series. Alrighty, folks, time to get going for part two. And our other reader, I think, needs no introduction, but I'm going to introduce him anyway, Mr. Paul Cornell.
Good evening, all. Thank you very much for coming along. I shall have to be very actorly tonight to try and match that. My goodness. This is the new book, Who Killed Sherlock Holmes? The third in the Shadow Police series, but an ideal jumping-on point for new readers. It's very new reader-friendly. In my London, the London of the Shadow Police, the collective memory of all Londoners, living and dead, creates ghosts that haunt the metropolis. And those ghosts can be the ghosts of real people who are deceased, or fictional characters, or mythological characters. It's whatever London thinks should be there. And thus, of course, the Sherlock Holmes Museum at 221B Baker Street has a particular inhabitant, or had. So, at this point, I'm going to read from Detective Constable Kevin Sefton has become aware that a disturbance in the ether has happened. Something awful is going on, and he follows it to its source at Baker Street. The interior of the museum was exactly what he'd expected. A ticket booth followed by a narrow staircase with captions pointing out exactly how authentic every piece of bric-a-brac was. Sefton felt uneasy as one of the assistant curators, a petite young woman with a ponytail, who identified herself as Anne Stanley, led him upstairs to Holmes's flat on the first floor. Clean-up today, she told him, had taken longer than usual, so exhausted she'd made use of the small room the museum kept for staff to stay over. This was the sort of building Sefton and his team were getting used to exploring, with every detail of its history shouting at them because they had the sight. Only, this one had been designed that way for ordinary people, and had nothing of the actual site about it. No real home, even of an eccentric Victorian detective, would have this much significant detail. They'd lined it out like nobody ever threw anything out or cleaned up. The items on display were props, fakes. That was why it all felt so nauseating to someone with a sight. None of these items sang with it as they should. The house felt vulnerable, compromised, as if by laying out all these things that should have the weight of the sight to them, it was inviting something terrible to happen that would lend them that property for real. The curator unlocked and let him into the consulting room, asking lots of questions, which suddenly Sefton couldn't hear, because now all his attention was taken up with what was in the centre of the room. Between a settee and a bearskin hearthrug, there lay the body of a man. He wore a deerstalker and one of those short capes. He lay on his back, one arm stretched out in what looked like a helpless plea towards the smaller of two desks in the corner of the room. Sticking out of his chest was a straight knife with some sort of decoration on the blade. The weapon tugged at Sefton with the gravity of the sight. It was the only thing here that did. Around the body had formed a pool of blood. "What's that knife doing here?" asked the curator, puzzled. She obviously couldn't see the body, or her reaction would have been much more urgent. Sefton dared to take a step nearer and looked down into the face of the dead man only he could see, a face that was changing, shifting continuously as Sefton watched. This was what had suddenly gone missing from London. His dream hadn't required any interpretation. He was at a crime scene, and the crime was the murder of Sherlock Holmes. It took little persuasion for the curator to accept that this was a crime scene. She'd seen enough procedural TV shows to understand that evidence could be invisible to the human eye, and the knife in the floor had startled her. Everything had been normal, she said, when she'd locked up this room at around 11 p.m. Sefton got her to call her bosses, which meant her leaving a message on their answer phone. That was perfect, because it meant that in the early hours, after first Quill and then Ross and Costain had arrived, and Sefton had interviewed the curator, taken her contact details and sent her own, the team had the place to themselves. Quill stared at the body, as if this was some mad joke being played on him. He looked, if possible, more burdened than ever. Before Sefton could ask if something else had happened, he was all business. "Is he solid?" "No, Jimmy. Sefton demonstrated, sticking the toe of his shoe right through the body's head. They all knew that the ghosts formed by London's remembering a real or fictional character had varying degrees of solidity. This time, they couldn't examine the corpse, couldn't even turn it over. Sefton had already taken a lot of photos using his phone, then checked that, to a sighted person, the body did actually show up in them. The image of the body was still multifaceted, changing as you looked at it, changing with the angle. It was, Sefton had realised, a combination of all the different Sherlocks, all the different actors. Loads he couldn't recognise, some in modern dress, many wearing the deerstalker and cape, which thus had a regular shape compared to the flickering of the rest of the image, and also a sort of pencilled version, which Sefton realised must be the strong memory created by the original illustrator of the Holmes stories, whose name Sefton couldn't remember. That added a flavour that, after a moment, he realised reminded him of an ancient Aha pop video. That thought had led to him filming the body on his phone until he was sure he'd caught the full cycle of incarnations as they flickered by. "No habeas corpus, then," said Ross, which might have been a joke, except that there was, as ever, no humour in her expression. "How is this even possible?" asked Costain, who looked like he might have wanted to make a few dark jokes himself, but was, as always now, restraining every expression of who he was for Ross's sake. "Well," said Sefton, who'd had a while to think about this, "if you mean, how is there a Sherlock Holmes, then I think it's obvious that there would be, or was, in our version of London. London remembers things that happened, but it equally remembers stuff that was just made up. Sherlock Holmes, very popular fictional character, huge link to London. A lot of people even think he's real. There's been Holmes mania with the three versions filming at once in town, getting everyone thinking about it," said Ross. "It's actually kind of obvious he'd be one of our ghosts." "If you mean, how do you kill a ghost," Sefton continued, "you've got me there. Why haven't we seen him before?" Costain had stepped closer to the body. "Where's he associated with?" said Ross, a rhetorical question, talking to herself, though Costain had looked up hopefully for a moment at the thought she might actually have addressed him. "Just this building. The ghost of Jack the Ripper was in Whitechapel. Every other place associated with Sherlock Holmes, is it Dartmoor in the Hound of the Baskervilles?" "Yeah," said Quill, "and there's the Reichenbach Falls, wherever that is." "Not in London," said Ross. "Yeah, I fucking know that," said Quill, startling her. Then he visibly chided himself. "Sorry." Sefton found himself frowning. That wasn't the Quill he knew. Costain was shaking his head like he fundamentally didn't believe what he was seeing. Ghost body, but not a ghost weapon. He gently tapped the dagger with the toe of his shoe. Sefton nodded. "To kill a ghost, you'd need a special weapon, and that would have to be a real object. Makes sense." Ross stepped to the edge of the blood pool, and with a reluctance born of many tangible crime scenes, put her finger in the liquid. "Blood isn't real," she said. She stepped into it to squat by the blade and waved aside the start of a warning from Quill. "We can't disturb something that isn't there. This weapon, though, is solid evidence." She took out her phone to take some closer photos of what Sefton had initially taken for decoration, but now could make out as a tiny row of what looked like stick men engraved on the blade. "There's an obvious question here. Is this coincidental to the Study in Scarlet murder, or some sort of weird copycat case, or is there a link?" "You said you'd felt somebody had gone missing from London," Quill said to Sefton, "that Holmes came to you in a dream. Did someone do this? Is this murder?" "Now we're wondering if ghosts commit suicide," murmured Costain, as if someone had to say it. "What do you mean, Jimmy?" asked Sefton. He didn't like that sound in Quill's voice. He was used to the voices of organised crime network bosses, that edgy mix of authority and paranoia. "I mean, maybe it's London saying something to us. Maybe this is, you know, symbolic." "That is the first time I have ever heard you use that word," said Costain. He was looking as uneasy as Sefton was, trying to find some banter here. Quill slowly shook his head. "The death of Sherlock Holmes? He's deduction. He's the idea you can, you know, pick apart something that's happened, find meaning to it, solve it. Maybe we're getting to the end of that being possible. Maybe soon nothing will mean anything." He suddenly artificially laughed, as if he realised how unlike his old self he sounded. "Cheerful thought, actually. Then we can retire. Go somewhere nice." His smile faded again. Ross made an audible clicking sound with her tongue, as if adding an annoyed full stop to an idea she wasn't willing to entertain. She got out her notebook. "I'm going to start recording all the details," she said, as if Quill hadn't spoken. "What about the rest of the room?" Sefton was glad of her moving things on. He took the evidence gloves from his pocket and put them on, which made Costain and finally Quill do that too. They examined the crime scene. Sefton had taken it to be undisturbed, but they swiftly found quite a few worrying changes to what the guidebook photo indicated was the norm. It was hard to see, but on one of the walls was drawn in chalk an upright rectangle, as if someone was planning to build a doorway there. "Look at this," said Costain. "Like Ballard used to get into the bank the other day." "So other people have something that can do that," said Sefton. "That speaks of a suspect leaving the scene." "Oh, wait a sec." He made a phone call and checked quickly with some bemused officers on night shift, finding that Ballard was still in his cell and the piece of chalk was safe and sound in evidence. No, he hadn't drawn anything on the cell wall. "The things," sighed Costain, "we have to worry about." They went back to work. In front of the grate of the fireplace, there was a strange, rather theatrical shoe, bigger than anyone could comfortably wear, with faded blue, gold, and red details, the toe of which was upturned. There was a hole in it, and from its side had poured a trail of what, with a sniff and the withholding of a sneeze, Sefton identified as tobacco. A pile of the stuff beside it had been formed into a spiral shape. "Bloody spiral," said Quill, suddenly sounding like he'd solved the case. Ross immediately came over and said it didn't look anything like the spiral patterns that which Maura Losley had left behind. And besides, those had been made of soil. She sounded like she wanted to add that Quill should have already noted those things. "That'd be a Persian slipper," said Costain, looking at the guidebook. The hole in said footwear looked like it had been cut. Sefton took a picture. As he did so, he glanced up and noticed something else. On the mantelpiece above the fireplace, there was a drawing of a woman in Victorian costume. There was something about her eyes. He stood and looked more closely. They'd each had the tiniest of pinpricks made in them. Under the drawing was a caption, "Irene Adler." Sefton pointed the holes out to Ross, the woman in Holmes's life. "You ever read any of the stories?" asked Sefton. "When I was a kid, she's in a lot of films and TV shows, isn't she?" Beside the photograph, a large knife was embedded in the mantelpiece. It was in the guidebook, so Sefton gathered it was a feature of the room as it should be. It held a bundle of letters with a 221B address at the top of the first one. Sefton leafed through them and noticed something. The others gathered round. Only the first two letters were complete, the top one being an appeal for help for somebody who'd lost their cat, the second one a letter from somebody complaining to Holmes about the noise of his violin playing. Both of them had a series of tiny holes punched in them, sometimes cutting out letters from words, sometimes not. "What the living fuck?" said Costain. He was shaking his head. He checked the guide again, but he couldn't find any reference to this being something from the Holmes stories. Sefton let his gaze drift to the right and realised that what he'd thought was a globe of the world was something entirely different. On top of another cabinet in the corner sat what once had been, he took a look at the guide, a wax bust of Holmes's head. However, the features had been melted, the eyes now streaks of colour, the nose a stalactite. Raising a hand to keep the others back, he put a finger on the wax inside. It wasn't even warm. "The curator," said Sefton, "said everything was normal at 11 p.m. That was the last time she looked in here. I had that dream maybe 5 minutes later. Maybe the dream was actually the moment the Holmes died? He seemed to be desperately asking for help." Ross was pointing to a series of bullet holes in the wall above a pile of books beside Holmes's desk, which formed letters VR. "I think that's an original feature, but this isn't." She was pointing at a series of thin red lines that connected several of the dots. "Looks like biro, not blood." "What's he pointing at?" said Quill, who had kept glancing back at the body. Indeed, now Sefton looked closely. The outstretched hand was flickering through some gestures that resembled pointing. He looked up in the same direction as Quill and found the smaller desk in the corner opposite, with pictures of two men above it. General Gordon, a contemporary of Holmes, died in a siege. Henry Ward Beecher, an American anti-slavery preacher. Or, as I suppose we can refer to them now, suspects. What was he working on? Quill had wandered to Holmes's own desk, to the left of which was pinned a map of the night sky, a diagram of the solar system, and an astronomical photo of lots of stars. "He wasn't working on anything," said Ross. "He's a fictional character in a museum. His ghost might have looked like it was working on something, but nothing remembered by London has agency, volition, and jet," said Quill. "Those charts and that photo aren't in the guidebook, and you just made an assumption based only on the limited amount of shit we've seen." Ross looked relieved to be corrected. She glanced to Sefton. "Yes, boss." Quill unpinned the astronomical map, diagram and photo and inspected them more closely. On the back of the photo was something that made him call them over to see. In an elegant, precise hand there was written, "The ultimate crime, I must solve it." "That," said Sefton, "would be a motive for murder. Holmes got too close to something." "Considering all the books and stuff," said Costain, "what would he think of as ultimate?" Ross was looking annoyed again. "I can't get used to the idea of him thinking," she said. "If he was, that's such an anomaly. It must mean something." "Maybe like a ghost like Holmes would work on crime," said Sefton. "That's what he was remembered for." "Quite a few people have had a go at doing Holmes's handwriting. They all looked a bit like that, but we sort of know what his writing should look like, don't we?" "Where's Watson?" said Costain. Sefton wanted to smack himself on the forehead. The sheer density of information in this murder room made seeing what was right in front of you bloody difficult. "Yeah, good point. Holmes was well known enough to be a ghost. Pinned down to this location, Watson would be too." "The curious case," said Costain, "of the Watson who wasn't there." "Moriarty," said Ross, seemingly the instant the idea came to her, "got to be suspect number one, surely. If you ask anybody the question, who killed Sherlock Holmes, that's the answer you'll get." "Maybe," said Sefton, "except Moriarty isn't as huge in the public imagination as Holmes is, and isn't linked to a London location. I don't think he'd have a ghost." "Wait a sec." Quill had been looking into the distance, the photo still in his hand. He was breathing hard. "I think this was sent to him," he said. He picked up an empty envelope from the desk, compared the size of it to the photo, and showed them the card backing. The stamps on the front were modern and carried a London postmark. The letter was addressed to Sherlock Holmes at the famous address. "He must get a lot of mail," said Sefton. "Some fictional characters do. I wonder where it's kept." "Whoever killed Holmes," said Ross, "left a room full of deliberate clues. That's a strike against Moriarty. His big thing was that you wouldn't suspect he was a criminal. He took care not to leave clues." Sefton went back to the other side of the room, found a bookcase containing volumes such as a reverse telephone directory and several bound collections of Holmes's own monographs. He opened one of them and was momentarily surprised to find the pages blank. They were props, of course. There were some gaps in the rows of books. He looked on the desk for them, then around the room. Why would somebody nick fake books? "Maybe it was an opportunist. Robbery gone wrong," said Costain. She looked incredulously at him, then realised he was joking and turned away, took a couple of steps away from him, angry at him all over again. Sefton watched Costain's face fall. He looked back to Quill, who was leaning on the wall, his expression far away. Sefton was suddenly angry with himself and with all of them. Don't do that," he yelled. The others all turned to look at him. "You've stepped right back into going through the motions, filling your roles, and that's great. That's what we should be doing. But if we keep doing only that, we will run ourselves into the ground, like you've already been doing for weeks now." "Kev," began Quill, a sigh in his voice. "But look at this. Look at it. It got to you when you saw that handwriting. I know it did. That Sherlock bloody Holmes lying dead right there. This has to be a change in how London remembers stuff if he doesn't just regenerate like a video game character or something like that. This is huge. Wait a sec." He checked his evidence gloves weren't torn, marched over, looked to Ross to check what he was going to do was okay, and at a nod from her, pulled the blade from the flickering body. He half expected Holmes to flash back into existence and become once more what he must have been before, the wraith of an idea haunting these chambers, but he didn't. Sefton straightened up and held the murder weapon high in the air. "This is the ultimate murder mystery, and this room displays a ton of evidence. What more do you need to get excited about what only we do? What more do you bloody need to snap out of it, to work together and be us again?" Costain was grinning at him, he realised, obviously relieved by what had been said. But still, Sefton was immediately a bit embarrassed at having made the closest to a stirring speech that he'd ever heard from anybody in the Metropolitan Police. "Kev, I mean it. Enough with the jokes from you." "No, I agree, and that's great. That's the best thing. But I just looked at the BBC news page." He held up his phone. "Another body's been found with Raish written on the wall. Do you want to say it or will I?" "What? Mate, the game is afoot." Bit long. I edited it down a bit as I spoke. Sorry.
Oh, that was fine, Paul. Thank you very much. And apologies for the momentary ghost music, which I presume was the ghost of the Shakespeare again. Was it, Chris? Yes? It was the ghost? Yes, it was the ghost. For those of you who are new, we have a ghost. The hi-fi system in here, the pub has it turned off while we're in here, but every so often somebody will go by with a powerful radio and we'll get voices on the thing, which is very, very weird. Anyway. Yeah. Anyway, it's now time for another break. Please buy drinks if you want them or visit the loos, and then we will be back shortly and put our readers to the question.
Bristol Con Fringe is a monthly reading series produced by the Bristol Con Foundation. Our thanks to the Shakespeare Tavern for providing us with a venue. The music at the beginning of this podcast is The Future by Chevy 174.